series. My name is Tyler Burton. I'm the Executive Director of Perimeter Institute, and it's truly a joy and a pleasure to see so many people here this evening. As you all know, it's a grand and glorious tradition in this part of the world that we wait until the Toronto Maple Leafs get out of the National Hockey League playoffs, and then we come down to a public lecture on foundations of quantum theory. So, we have a wonderful event for you this evening. We have three very knowledgeable and entertaining individuals whom I would like to present to you. You've seen two of these people before. If you're regular readers of The Kitchen or One of the Record, you know they've been profiled in the Explorer series. The gentleman that you see who's immediately to my left, Anthony Valentini, is a long-term visitor at the Institute, has been here for a very long time, and he's a marvelous violinist and a very brilliant and innovative thinker in foundations of quantum theory. The gentleman to his left, whom you doubtless don't recognize because of his sunglasses, is Wade Mervold, a philosopher of science from University of Western Ontario. I should have given you a little bit more of an introduction. Rather, Anthony received his PhD from CISA, Trieste, in Italy, and has gone on to do postdoctoral fellowships in Imperial College and in Rome. Wade Mervold, a philosopher of science, received his PhD in philosophy from Boston University and his undergraduate degree in physics from Yale University. To his left, Lucien Hardy, another famous member of the Perimeter Circle, renowned foundations of quantum theory researcher and quantum information theory researcher, received his PhD from Durham University and has been a long-term researcher at Perimeter Institute since 2002. So a big round of applause for all of our speakers. Two things before I describe the format of this evening's festivities. I should tell you that I have urged two of the three researchers you see before you to abandon their typical professional conservatism when it comes to matters of scientific discourse. Let them know that this is a public event. They can be and are encouraged to be speculative. They are encouraged to be at times theatrical, and they might even be encouraged to be reckless. Mr. Valentini needs no such encouragement on him. I have the pleasure of stating the issue, as it were. We're going to discuss, or at least start off discussing, the renowned two-slit experiment, the double-slit experiment, which will highlight some of the foundational issues in quantum theory. I have the opportunity to bring that to the fore, make a very brief presentation, after which all of our combatants will have 15 minutes each to hold forth on their particular interpretations of quantum theory. And then we will have a question and answer period with members of the general audience and perhaps some lively discussion amongst our researchers as well. So one other thing I suppose I should mention before I go into my presentation, you may have noticed that things have moved up a notch in terms of professionalism. Here we had Chilean music as you entered, and we have all sorts of video and sound security and wonderful technical abilities. Those of you who are regular readers of the Globe and Mail on the Record might have noticed that we had a sexier ad this time, which has resulted in so many more people coming. That's all due to our new director of communications, John Matlock, who has something else in store. In true razzle-dazzle fashion, we're going to be giving away a grand prize at the end of this evening's festivities, so I'm telling you that you should hold on to your tickets, which also means that you have to stay in your seats. And I also want to let you know that we're going to be having photographers for our new brochure who will be taking pictures. And they needed these large lights that we turned off because there were difficulties with some people at the back seeing the screen. So we're going to wait until the question and answer period before we turn those lights on again. But don't be concerned if you see photographers prowling around It's just the press that in my physics event, we're all used to that by now. So, without any further ado, I will move towards my brief presentation. And I thought I'd start off with some quotations. And I know it's common in such activities to be reading quotations, but since we're also marvelously intelligent here in Waterloo Region, you don't need me to read for you. So what I will do, what I will do is just move along to various different quotes. But I will read at least part of the last one, which is my favorite. And as I put these quotes up, I'll just hold forth, if I may, for a few moments about quantum theory in general. I'll try not to get in the way. The quantum mechanics is a spectacularly successful theory. In fact, most people regard it as the most successful theory in the history of physics because of its empirical verification. How many times it's been tested, how many times the experimental data confirms the theoretical prediction. But there are deep issues with understanding exactly what's going on. And there are many people that treat that in very different ways. As I said on a previous occasion, Richard Feynman's famous quote is that if you look at this too long, you'll go down the drain. And I'll leave it for you to decide whether the individuals to my left have looked at it for a long period of time and have in fact gone down the drain or not. The last quote, as I said, is really a favorite of mine, and I will read this one, or at least part of it, also by Dick Feynman, who wrote, "It has not yet become obvious to me that there is not a real problem. I cannot define the real problem. Therefore, I suspect there is no real problem, but I'm not sure there's no real problem." So what was he talking about? Well, what I will do is I will put up three transparencies that deal with three different experiments. The first one is an experiment with bullets. This comes directly from Feynman's lectures on physics, volume 3, or as I put in the references, pretty well anywhere else. So this is about as common as you can possibly find. We have three different experiments, and the first one consists of a gun right here, firing off bullets. And these bullets go through a screen with two slits. So this is slit one and slit two. These are gaps. And we have a detector over here, which measures whether or not a bullet has been received. And sometimes the bullets bounce off the edge here, and sometimes they go straight through, and sometimes they go through this slit, and sometimes they go through that slit. And at the end of the day, we count up how many times the bullets have landed in various different positions along this axis here, and we plot them. Of course, it's obvious that we either receive a bullet or no bullet. We don't get half a bullet, we don't get a third of a bullet. We're all familiar with this. And we plot these results, and we find that if we close this second slit, and we measure how many bullets we're getting, we have a high probability of getting a bullet right over here. That's what this graph over here represents. So most of the bullets are detected right over here. So if we plot this on a curve, we notice that most of the bullets are right behind slit number one. Well, that's obvious because we close slit number two. Most of the bullets are going through slit number one. And so we have a distribution in terms of the probability. If we had 100 bullets that we were firing at each particular interval through this gun, we find most of them would be behind slit number one. And similarly, if we close slit number one and we open slit number two, we find something similar with the distribution of probabilities peaked around slit number two. And if we would open both slits, we would expect that we would just add the probabilities of these curves. And so we would add these curves to get a curve that looks something like this. This would be the probability of finding a bullet when both slits are open. Because after all, the bullet has to either go through slit number one or through slit number two. That's the story of bullets. Now we're going to move to waves. and just talk about classical waves, any waves you want. Water waves, sound waves, whatever. Water waves are perhaps good to visualize. So here we have a source over here, something in the water that is vibrating up and down and producing water waves that are coming through. We also have two slits for a stream. So each of these slits acts as point sources and in fact produces two more waves coming out. We know that this time what we're going to measure is we're going to measure intensity. So we can measure that in various different ways. We can imagine this being buoys on water and measure how high the buoys go up and down in various different places. And so that's part of the picture. So we're measuring intensity. Now intensity actually represents effectively the square of the height of the buoys going up and down. So it's not exactly the height, it's the square of the height, but that doesn't really matter. So you measure the intensity and you find, again, if you close this slit number one, you find that you have the highest amount of intensity here because you don't have any contribution from this slit, this wave that would come out. It doesn't exist. And similarly, if you were to close this slit number two, you would have something similar over here. So again, you would have intensities looking like this. So the intensity would be peaked, because it would be dependent on the height. The intensity would be peaked behind slit number one if you close slit number two. And similarly, it would be peaked behind slit number two if you close slit number one. Now what happens if you open both of the slits in this particular case? Well, as we all know, the waves interfere. So sometimes you'll get the crest of one wave hitting the trough of another, and you won't get any wave left. You'll have interference. Sometimes they will interfere positively, you'll get a very high wave. Sometimes they will interfere negatively, and they will cancel each other out. This interference pattern is plotted over here. Now that we know this, this is a physical effect, and you can test it by going to any water, any lake or pond or bathtub, and trying this sort of experiment out. We represent this mathematically, this interference effect, by saying that this number h here, if you care about this, is actually complex. So what we have to do is we have to take into account both slits and recognize the interference. And so we use this fancy notation, this mathematical notation of complex numbers, basically to say we know there's interference going on, and this is the way we manifest it mathematically. So that's the story with waves. Now we move on to electrons. And here's where quantum mechanics really gets interesting. So we have the same setup as we had before. We have a gun that's emitting single particles, in this case electrons, they're quantum particles. Again, they go through a screen with two slits, slit one and slit two. Again, there's a detector, and again we find that we either get one electron or no electrons, just like we did for bullets. And again we find, if we close slit number one, we're going to get a probability of finding electrons over here, peaked behind slit number two, and similarly if we close slit number two. But now we find if we leave both slits open, we get an interference effect. So we find if we have both slits open, there are areas where before the electron would have been quite happy to be if only one of the slits was open, and now it's not going to be there. Now we represent this mathematically the same way we represented the waves mathematically, using complex numbers and adding these things, which I'm now calling phi, as amplitudes. But there are very, very deeply disturbing things that are going on. How does the electron know, is the classic argument, if the electron, when you close slit number two, happened to have gone through slit number one, it could have landed anywhere. It has a lower probability of landing here than landing right here. But it could have landed anywhere. But if the electron enters slit number one and slit number two happens to be open, then there are all sorts of places that it can't be. So the question is, how did the electron know that? Well, maybe that's not the right way to phrase the question, and I'll leave it to my colleagues to assess whether or not that's legitimate. Let me give you another slide of this two-slit experiment to remind you that these are collections of individual electrons. So if you were to do this, and you were to shoot electrons at this two slit experiment, and you were to measure them over here, you would find that there would be statistical regions where electrons would be and statistical regions where electrons wouldn't be. There would be gaps. And this reflects what I'm talking about. So, I have to hurry up because I'm going to urge my colleagues to hurry up even more. Let me put up my last transparency. So as I said before, here are some of the issues. According to quantum mechanics, you can't simply say that the electron went through slit one or slit two. To some extent, you have to say that the electron went through slit one and slit two. Now, this is a very mind-boggling concept. And in fact, if I just go to the bottom of this transparency, this really gets to the heart of quantum theory and what's known as the superposition principle. And what I also want to say, because Lucien's going to speak to this later on, is that, of course, this is an idealized experiment, but in quantum theory, there are all sorts of different possibilities that may occur, analogous to going through slit one or slit two. It doesn't have to be just two cases of the superposition principle. There could be an extremely large number of different cases that a quantum particle can be in, or one has to take into account as part of the representation of this quantum particle, which is known as the wave function. And so there are various different states that this can be in according to the superposition principle. They also don't have to be equally weighted. So what we had before was we had two paths and they both have the same probability. But in general, we could have all sorts of different possibilities in the superposition principle and all sorts of different weights. So what's important to remember for a quantum particle is that there's always this and function, this and that the particle went through to some extent slit one and slit two, or at least you have to take that into account very deeply. There's more to talk about, but I'm not going to talk anymore. I think that's the kernel of the problem, or at least all I wanted to get to. And now I'm going to turn it over to Anthony to speak to you about his interpretation.
Who did most of his work in the 1920s. This theory was taken up again by David Bohm in 1952, but it's been generally ignored for most of the 20th century. As I just said at the outset, that with respect to scientific evidence, I think it's correct to say that we don't know if the details of this theory are correct or not. But I think that it's the best theory we have at the moment, and I hope that it's at least approximately true. De Broglie, in around 1923, started with the idea that material bodies, particles or a stone, any material object, which Newton had the idea that the motion of objects is determined by forces like gravity, or if you push on something. De Broglie had the idea that each object is accompanied by an invisible wave that guides its motion. And of course, in the 19th century, we became used to the idea that there could be invisible waves like the electromagnetic waves. When you turn on your radio, you don't see a wave coming in or out of the radio, but nevertheless, we believe that electromagnetic waves are real, and they affect things. Louis de Broglie had the idea that there would be a new kind of wave that was not really known to physics yet, not at that time, which guides the motion of particles. I'm standing away, sorry. So in this theory, just here at the bottom, I'm just reminding you a little bit about waves. I'm not going to be terribly precise in this talk. I'm just trying to give you the intuitive idea of things. So here you have a wave, you could think of it as a water wave oscillating up and down, and these peaks of the wave are the wave crests. This is the height of the wave. Now, in general, if I have a wave spreading out through space like this, De Broglie proposed that the particle is guided by the wave according to a simple law, which can be written down mathematically, but whose content is that the particle moves perpendicular to the crest of the wave, and it moves faster when the crests are closer. So here, where, if you like, the wavelength is shorter, the particle moves faster. So in this example here, the particle would be speeding up as it moves to the right. That's Louis de Broglie's theory of motion in a nutshell. And as I said, he proposed that in his doctoral thesis of 1924. And he applied it to various simple situations, such as the following one. Okay, here's a single slit. And if we have a wave incident on a single slit, it diffracts, it spreads out, and as Hal explained, the backstop, the amplitude squared of the wave would have a sort of distribution as shown in that green curve. Now, that's the motion of the wave. What about the particles being guided by the wave? So, here is some examples of, as I said, the particles move. So here I've drawn five different trajectories. The trajectories depend on where the particle starts. So it moves all perpendicular to the crest of the wave. These are the kinds of trajectories that this theory predicts. And if the particles start out spread uniformly, I have a plain uniform wave coming in. If the particles start out uniformly distributed, the fraction of particles that lands at different points at the backstop will match that green curve. Okay, it will match what is observed if you start out with this uniform distribution coming in. Now, what about when I have two slits, this supposedly terribly mysterious situation, where you have two slits, as we've already seen how it showed, you have two waves coming out of the two slits, and they interfere. If you ever drop two stones into a pond and you see the ripples coming out, when they overlap, they form a complicated pattern of wave crests. What does the Broglie theory of motion predict for motion of the particles in this case? What you find is, again, the particle follows, moves perpendicular to the wave crest, and in the region where you have this complicated interference pattern, where these two waves are overlapping, the trajectories become quite complicated, the particle wheels around. And what you find is, and it can be shown quite straightforwardly, is that if the initial particles coming in are distributed uniformly across this incident wave coming in, then the distribution of particles at the backstop, the fraction that lands at different points, matches that green curve. So where the green curve is high, you get more particles landing there. Where the green curve is very small, there are less particles land there. If you just want to see a little more detail, here's the results of some computer calculations of these trajectories for the two slit experiments. So particle coming through the top slit, it wiggles around, and it actually stays in the top half of this picture. Now at this point, so at this point you might be wondering, well, hang on, what's going on? You've given what seems like a very simple, straightforward explanation of this interference pattern. So why did Richard Feynman, for example, say that nobody understands this, or that why do so many physicists say, why do most textbooks say that this experiment proves that the electron did not go through one slit or the other? Now, this is very strange, because this phenomenon that is observed experimentally was first observed in the laboratory in 1927 by Davison and Germer with crystal diffraction of electrons. But that this phenomenon would exist was first predicted by de Broglie in 1924, 3 years earlier. And he predicted it using the theory with particle trajectories. So how can this phenomenon, particle interference, disprove trajectories? It was first predicted with a theory that used trajectories. And the answer really is that textbooks tend to be written by people who have ignored this theory. This theory of de Broglie and Lady Bohm was simply ignored, and most physicists didn't even know about it and never studied it, and repeated the claims made by Niels Bohr and Heisenberg and other people who said it's impossible to explain this experiment with trajectories, which is really quite crazy when you think that the phenomenon was first predicted by a theory based on trajectories. Now that's not to say that this theory is sort of simple, mundane, common sense type theory, because when you extend it to more than one particle, it becomes very remarkable theory. If I have one particle, I can describe its position with three numbers, say the height from the floor, the distance from that wall and that wall. With three numbers, I can say where a particle is. If I have two particles, I need six numbers. If I have three particles, I need nine numbers. Now, these numbers form what we call a configuration space. It's a higher dimensional space. And it turns out that for this theory to work, when you're describing more than one particle, the wave, this guiding wave, has to exist in this higher dimensional configuration space. Now, I can't draw you a six-dimensional space to represent two particles. So let me show you a simple case. If I have two particles in one dimension, okay, particles A and B, and here, let me forget that one there and that one there. They're not there. So I have two particles, A and B, and I can represent their positions by a single point in the two-dimensional space. And in this configuration space, there is this guiding wave, and that point moves perpendicular to the wave crest. Okay. Now, there is this remarkable feature here, that if you now imagine that the position of particle A was different, let's move particle A over here. Okay. The representative point for these two particles is now shifted over here. The position of B hasn't changed. It's only the position of particle A that has changed. But now, according to the guidance law, remember the speed of the particle is greater when the crests are closer together. Now the particles are moving faster. Even particle B will move faster. So what that means is I have two particles. It could be very far away, and the speed of one particle depends instantaneously on the position of the other particle. And many physicists are worried by this. Why? They're worried by anything that goes faster than light, and it's often claimed that, well, this can't be true because relativity says that you can't have signals going faster than light, but of course it could just be that at this deeper level of physics, relativity theory breaks down, which is what I believe. One interesting question is why can't we use these effects to send messages faster than light? And according to this theory, the reason is the following. Remember I said that you get the standard interference pattern, the pattern of arrival at the backstop, only if the incident particles have this uniform distribution. They have a distribution that matches the incoming wave. Now, it turns out in this theory in principle, you could consider a distribution of particles that does not match. Give an example here. If I had particles that if all the particles, for instance, came through the top slit, if they were all bunched in this area, they would all end up in this half of the screen, and you would only get a half of this pattern. There's no reason in this theory why the particles have to be distributed uniformly along this line, okay? If they are so distributed, then you get quantum theory, okay? If they're not so distributed, you would get different predictions from quantum theory. Now, you can show in this theory that if you have these non-standard distributions, then you would be able to see these faster-than-light effects. What is sort of happening, if you can imagine, these different particles are interacting faster than light, but the information, this instantaneous information, is in a sense scrambled by statistical noise. And as an analogy, I'll just be 1 minute. As an analogy, what do I mean scrambled by statistical noise? Imagine you had coins lying on the table showing heads or tails. And imagine that someone very far away had some magic button they could press that made all the coins flip over. Okay? Now imagine that you can't keep track of each individual coin. You can only count the number of heads and tails. Now, if initially, if at the beginning I had half heads and half tails, when this person far away does this magic flip, well, at the end I still got half heads and half tails, and I wouldn't notice any difference. Okay? Whereas, if I had a non-standard distribution, if you like, of heads and tails, let's say 30% heads and 70% tails, if now all the coins flip over, well, now I'm going to get 70% heads and 30% tails, and I would see a difference. Now, according to this theory, the world is full of things like this, where things that happen far away do change the individual outcomes of what happens, for instance, to electrons, but we don't notice them because on a statistical level, the distribution of electrons is such that overall, you don't notice them. And similarly, so what we really need, if you want to send messages faster than light, for these effects to actually be used, you would have to find particles that have a distribution different from this, as I said, this uniform incoming distribution. If we found a particle, and you might ask why all known particles have this distribution that matches the amplitude of the incoming wave, and it's my belief that this distribution originates from complicated interactions in the past in the early universe, which scrambled the particle positions to produce that distribution. So that all the particles we see that came out of the Big Bang have the same quantum distribution, which hides these non-local effects from direct view. And I'd better stop there. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
The story that Anthony just told about these particle trajectories on the totally one theory, or something very much like it, has just got to be right. Okay, it's supposed to be a debate. Okay, it's just got to be right if one of the assumptions that Anthony was making is true. And I want to accuse Anthony of being far too conservative about this. Because one of the assumptions that Anthony was making was the usual textbook thing that people say about how the quantum mechanical wave function evolves is right. And because if you make that assumption, something like the story that Anthony is telling has got to be true, and that includes relativity being wrong at the fundamental level, I want to raise a certain suspicion about what he's doing. So, I want to raise at least a suspicion. At least a suspicion that Anthony Fauli-Dade-Bogel is just taking the Schrodinger equation far too seriously and extrapolating far beyond the domain where we have good evidence that works. Now, let me explain why that's, you know, why would I guess that's true? That's all. Pretend that's a crash and happen with some ladies. Okay. That's better. Yeah, I would be better off if I'd drawn it with everyone else rather than taking an actual photograph of waves from a ripple tape. A story that Anthony tells you. You've got the quantum mechanical wave function. And then in addition to that, there's these particles with these definite trajectories. And I see Anthony and I have the same book, so we're trajectories, so not from the same thing. And so, that would be what an ensemble of trajectories would look like. It'd be actual particles going along these waves, doing that logic that Anthony was talking about, and doing these with trajectories. Now, why does he add this extra stuff? Why does he add this, these particles that he's been talking about, I don't think he emphasizes this enough, these particles with definite trajectories go beyond the ordinary quantum theory. Well, why does he add it? Well, what do you know? What if the quantum mechanical wave function is everything? Well, if you use the usual laws, the textbook laws, these very conservative assumptions that Anthony was assuming, it tells how the quantum mechanical wave function changes in time. You start out with a superposition of wave going through one split and the other. That goes into superposition of corresponding particle detected at various points on the screen. And if you really take quantum mechanics seriously, there's going to be a wave function associated with that detector. And that detector is going to be going to a superposition of detecting the particle here and detecting the particle here. And I walk in and I look at that detector, and if you really take quantum mechanics seriously, and if you really think that the wave function is all there is, and you really think that it follows this Schrödinger equation all the time, I'm going to have some complicated wave function associated with me. And I'm going to go into superposition of seeing various things, and we got to the point where it doesn't seem to make sense. And this has been pointed out long ago, the most famous example of this sort of thing that happens when you take the wave function to be everything there is and take it to satisfy the Schrödinger equation at all time was made up by Schrödinger himself. And I'm sure we've all heard of Schrödinger's cat, which he called a ridiculous case. He didn't really think this is what happened. And the idea is you take, this is a terrible thing to do, but I don't know why we use this example, but you take, some kind of radioactive nucleus which could either decay or not a certain amount of time. You put it in a box with a Geiger counter. You rig up this, to his credit, Schrödinger called it a diabolical device. He didn't actually advocate for the cast. You rig it up so that if the particle decay is detected, it triggers some device which smashes a vial of poisonous gas. And if you treat everything quantum mechanically, wave function is all there is, and just follow the evolution according to Schrödinger equation, the cat, the whole thing ends up in a superposition of a state in which the cat's alive and a state in which the cat's dead. And I think Schrödinger is right that is ridiculous. And I want to emphasize how different this is anything from anything we think the cats actually do. A superposition of a state in which the cat is alive and a state in which the cat's dead isn't a state in which the cat is kind of sickly and just barely hanging on for life. If the state, superposition state in which the cat is alive and well and frisky, and a state in which the cat is dead on a doornail, no component of a sick cat in there. And it's also not the same as a situation in which the cat is either alive or dead, and we just don't know it. The wave, that is, if the wave function is everything there is. The wave function itself has both of these components in it, and if you want to say, well, actually one of those components is the actual state, then you're adding something to the wave function, which is what Anthony is doing. You add something to the wave function that picks up one of these components of the superposition as the actual state, then everything's okay. And that's pretty much what you have to do. Because after all, at the end of the day, when we actually do something like this, we get one of two results. Either the particle is decayed and the cat's alive, or the particle is not decayed and the cat is dead. So one way to achieve that is to add something extra to the quantum mechanical wave function, and it's pretty much, if you really believe the Schrödinger equation is how the quantum mechanical wave function evolves, it's pretty much the only way to do it. Which is why I started out saying that if this assumption that Anthony makes is right, then something like the story he's telling is definitely right. But then there's one question, well, what if that's not right? What if the Schrödinger equation, which is what leads to these desired two positions, is almost but not quite right? And it's not quite right in just the way that superpositions of macroscopically distinct states like live cat and dead cat don't occur. And another way of asking that is, if we did the double slit experiment with large or very complicated objects, would it turn out the same way? Or might it be possible to modify the Schrödinger equation that you get this subtraction pattern when you deal with electrons, but get the bullet type experience behavior that Howard was talking about at the beginning when you start with bullets? And this is an experimental question. This is a question that we can actually address. We actually have very good evidence that the Schrödinger equation is right or very close to right, but the evidence is restricted pretty much to microscopic type stuff. And we should ask whether or not we really should extrapolate that and really believe that there are these bizarre quantum superpositions of the wave function in macroscopic states. And so I just want to finish with sort of an overview of what we do and don't know about this sort of thing. We know that distance isn't just enough. You can get distinctive quantum effects over particles separated by very large distances, as much as 10 kilometers. Actually doing the double slit experiment with macroscopic objects, well, I'm amazed that in my lifetime we got this far, and I'm looking forward to getting even further, because the experimentalists, and if you'd asked me 10 years ago, I would have said, no, this just can't be done, have actually managed to do a double slit experiment, not with just electrons, but with fairly big, substantial molecules. Some of you may have heard about buckyballs or Buckminster fullerene. This is a form of carbon that has either 60 carbon atoms or 70 carbon atoms. Those are pretty big molecules. Now, they're nothing compared to, say, DNA molecules or something like that, but they're pretty big as molecules, though, and when you do the diffraction with that, you get exactly the quantum mechanical predicted diffraction effect. And another thing that's often cited as a macroscopic Schrödinger cat type state is this actually in a superconducting device, it's actually possible to perform a current in a superposition going one way around the loop and another way around the loop. But again, we're still a long way from cats on this. And I actually think it makes sense to try to ask whether the Schrödinger equation isn't quite right, whether or not the real law of nature for the wave equation is something that gives us something that agrees with those results in that domain, but nevertheless leads to familiar classical stuff in the classical domain. This is a project that's still in its infancy. There's been some work done along the lines of developing such theories, but we haven't got to the point where anyone's got a theory that anyone takes sort of as a serious candidate for the way the world is. But I think it's a project that's worth doing, and part of the reason I think that it's a project worth doing is I think that there's at least hope for achieving it without having that nasty violation of relativity that Anthony was talking about.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
That really works. So
here's a question. What is physics about? What's the reason for doing this? One answer you might give to that question is that the reason we do physics is because we want to be able to describe independently existing world. We want to be able to describe a world which exists independently of ourselves. You might say this is like trying to provide a God's eye view of the world. You might imagine there's God. This is actually William Blake painting. And here's a physicist. He's asking, I wonder what the world looks like from up there. And I think that's a very good idea of what physics should be about, if that's possible. And certainly the approach that Anthony, and also the approach that Blake described to you, fits well into this picture. They're trying to describe, well, in Anthony's case, they're trying to describe a world in which God sees the world as consisting of particles of wave moving around independently of any physicist. And in Wayne's case, you just have the waves. And certainly, until a number of years ago, I personally subscribed to this point of view very strongly. But then I defected. And I'm hoping to explain to you why I defected. Okay, so here's a typical quantum experiment. We have here's some source of electrons. Perhaps some wavy lines to indicate electrons. We don't actually see those, it's just green lines just indicate something. You imagine something's there. Here's a double slit. And then the thing you actually see is the electron arriving at the screen. And this is a typical experiment in quantum theory, and experiments in quantum theory are usually of this form. And here's a slightly more abstract version of this type of experiment. Here we have three boxes. The first one is where you prepare some quantum system, and that's similar to this box here. The second box is where you perform some kind of transformation, you do some changes to the quantum system. Okay, in this case, you have a double slits, and here I'm representing it abstractly by a second box. And then the third box is where you make some measure to extract something that you can see. And in this case, you have a screen. And here I'm representing it schematically by a box here. This is a huge representation of boxes. And here on this box, we have a number of lights, and one of those lights will flash, for example, this light here. You see, in this case, you can move these things around. For example, you can move this box here, this light source further away, up and down. You can move this bit around, and likewise this screen. I'm representing this schematically by these knobs here, which you can change. So changing the position of this knob is, in a real case, something like moving this box around and this place and so on. Okay, so that's a schematic situation of what the experiment looks like in quantum theory. And yet there's something missing. Okay, this is what's missing. I didn't have time to redraw this, when I drew this guy, he looked really ugly. I gave him a hat. I think I drew this quite a lot. So what's missing is that in this scheme, what you actually have is some physicist standing there, and he's he's setting the knobs and he's making observations to see what's happening. So I want to keep that picture in mind. Not the ugly face, but and it's interesting because here's a second painting by Blake, this one here. And there Blake is representing Newton. This painting is called Newton. He's representing Newton in very much the same way he represented God in the first painting I showed you. And the idea is that you can imagine that Newton is somehow trying to imagine what the universe looks like as if it were God. There's a second painting you can find in the internet research of Newton. I don't know who the artist is, but it's very different. Here you have a picture of Newton, and here is Naples majestic with his hand, and he's looking at this screen here, and that's very similar to the previous picture I showed you of the guy with the hat. Except he doesn't have a hat. Okay, that's not a key difference. And what I want to do is I want to promote the idea that we should go away from this point of view of the action of the role of the physicist or scientist in general, but over to this kind of point of view. So here I'm describing what I call the view from within the world. So it's true that we are, as physicists, as scientists, as people in general, we are immersed in the world. Okay? And what happens at the end of the day is you have a long record of memory of the sort of things that happen. And you think, I woke up, I got to bed, I saw the alarm clock, it didn't go off. That kind of thing. You have a long list of observations that you make from within the world, things you did and things you saw. And the same is true of everyone. That's what consists, that's what makes up our data in any experiment. An experimentalist goes into the lab and he says, I did this, I saw that, you know, I put the dots there, I saw an electron arrive on the screen here. And in fact, for any physical theory to be useful, it has to be able to have to make predictions of some sort, which are from within the world. Predictions about things that people see. Now, the point of view I want to put across is that I think this aspect, the view from within the world, is fundamental. And one might go even a step further, I have to admit I lose sleep over this. It might be that there simply isn't a God's eye point of view. And I think this is quite crazy. I hope that one doesn't have to go that far, but it might be that really what quantum theory is trying to tell us is that we have to give up the God's eye point of view. Okay, so that's all crazy, like I said. What was it that led me to all this? Well, it stemmed from some work I did in 2001. And what I was trying to do was derive quantum theory from some set of principles which are in some sense more reasonable. So the motivation was that if you look at the usual formalism of quantum theory, it's very abstract, it has lots of evidence in mathematics that just seem to come from nowhere. There's no reason why a quantum state should be described by an operator on a complex Hilbert space, for example, that's just given by the theory. That's just something that's written down. It would be nice if you could show that quantum theory came from some set of reasonable principles. And so this is what I tried to do a few years back. And here are the five principles. I'm not sure I have time to describe all of these principles in any detail. But the key thing is that these principles are rooted from a sort of philosophical point of view. They are rooted in this image I showed you earlier. They are rooted in this image here. These principles make reference to the setup that I'm showing you here. So there are five principles. The crucial principle is this one here, number four. And what this says is that you can transform a system gradually between its pure states. I'll sort of explain how that works in a particular case. So in classical physics, imagine you have a bit in a computer, for example. You have a bit of information represented by a 0 or a 1. So this could be, for example, a ball, which is in this box or this box. Then you can say, well, we want to take the system from being in the 0 state to being in the 1 state. Well, in some sense, there isn't any state in between. Either it's zero or it's one. It might be that you don't know if it's zero or one. It might be some uncertainty. But nevertheless, the ball is actually either here or here. And in a sense, you have to jump to go from a zero to a one in classical physics. But in quantum physics, on the other hand, you have what are called superpositions. So, for example, the ball could be in a superposition of being in this, an atom, could be in a superposition of being in this box. Now, you can have superpositions with different weights, just as how I said at the beginning. So, for example, the ball could be 100% in this box and 0% in this box. Or it could be 100% in this box and 0% in this box. Or it could be anything in between. So, for example, it could be 1% in this box and 99% in this, and so on. And there's a gradual set of states between those two possibilities. So, in some sense, you can go gradually between 0 and 1. And this is really what I mean by this axiom 4. So these axioms make essential reference to this kind of setup with these boxes and these knobs and this guy changing the knob and looking to see what happens. One way of seeing it is like this. Here's some guy, and he's got a hand here, and he's looking, he's changing things in his experimental apparatus, and then he's observing and seeing what the consequences are. And maybe there are two people around, and there's another guy looking, he can change his hand, looking to see what the consequences are. And you can say that we are actor observers immersed in some kind of reality, trying to make sense of it. And it seems that, from the work I did, it seems that quantum theory, in some sense, is actually a consequence of this particular aspect of what you might call the human condition. It seems that quantum theory is something which elevates this and this to a fundamental level. So what we have here is a funny thing where what I'm providing is really a top-down description. I'm saying you take things like boxes, hands, the eyes, and you take a particular aspect of those, namely the fact that there is this two-way flow of information between observations and actions. You don't have to worry about a particular detail, but this guy's got four fingers or five fingers. taking particular details of this, we're taking some very simple aspects of the macroscopic world, namely that we observe and we form actions, and we're using those to try and obtain the laws of quantum theory, which apply to small things like atoms and photons. Once we have the laws of quantum theory that apply to small things like atoms and photons, then we can give a bottom-up explanation to describe the appearance of big things. So sort of like this. But what I want to say is I think this top-down aspect of this friendly circle explanation is the fundamental one. So, in a nutshell, the opinion that I'm expressing here, which I think might be radical, is that quantum theory is a consequence of taking a view from within the world. It's a consequence of taking the from within the world point of view to be fundamental. It's a consequence of taking this sort of diagram to be fundamental. And a big question for me is, does this mean that we have to abandon any notion of there being a God's-like point of view at some fundamental level? And I'm not sure I know the answer, but it might be that we have to actually go that one step further and abandon trying to have a God's-like point of view. Just as I was listening to Anthony O'Wayne. So what I try to do is derive quantum theory from some particular point of view. and I derive all the equations of the framework of quantum theory within that point of view. My challenge to Anthony and Wayne would be to do the same thing, to derive all the equations of your interpretation of quantum theory from some simple set of principles. So, for example, Anthony should derive the particular equation that guides these particles that he talks about from some simple set of principles. And likewise, Wayne should derive the particular equations that say how Schrodinger's equation should be modified to give rise to this collapse. Okay, thank you.
At this point, we will open up the floor for questions. We have not ready to go. So we'll open up the floor for questions. We have people going through the audience with roaming microphones. Yes, you. So please put your hands up, and if you're addressing your question to one particular researcher, please be so kind as to delineate that. We have no questions. We understand everything. There's one question over here. Another question over there. Excuse me. We have more questions in microphones. That's the issue.
During our standing question. Lucien, it seems to me that what you're saying about the position of the observer being on the outside of the universe, in order to end, it seems to me that every formal theory infers the position of the observer, as you state. And that if there's going to be a quantum theory of the universe, then the observer has to be on the outside of the universe. And this reminds me of Russell's paradox, that the set of all sets that are not members themselves. For the observer to be on the outside, he cannot be a member of the set. So the observer is on the outside. But this is a contradiction to the fact that the observer is a member of the set. So you have this circular impossibility that the observer is both, both positions of the observer are contradictory.
Okay. So I think it's true that normally people say that if you take the sort of approach that I'm taking, then you have to think of the observer as being outside the system that you're looking at. I think that's a mistake. I think that you don't have to think in those terms, that you can perfectly well imagine the thing that's being observed being the observer themselves. So an example would be if Galileo himself was the jump off for the entire Pisa. And whilst he's jumping, he would look at his watch and take down notes as to what time he fell past subsequent floors. And seeing there's some kind of thing at the bottom of the then there's an example where the guy is observing himself. And he's part of the system, yet he's making observations. So I think you can get around the problem in that way.
Can I accept something? I think it was not the point that all theories agree on. And we probably have emphasized this, that because you do hear in standard quantum theory things that we have to divide the world up into the stuff quantum systems would be quantum mechanically, and then there's the measuring apparatus or observer which we treat classically. And I think that certainly Anthony and I think we all agree that there's something really fundamentally wrong with that. We are physical systems immersed in the world and acting in it. And the physical theory that says no, you can't treat the observing system the same laws as the observed system. There's just something wrong with that. And neither the sort of dynamic collapse theory that, in fact, both the sort of dynamic collapse theories that I was talking about and the de Broglie-Rome theory are attempts to treat everything on the same basis and not make that split.
That's right. Any other questions? We have somebody over here.
Yeah, I'm not a physicist. I've read a lot on quantum mechanics and understood very little. I understand that the observer has a special role in collapsing the wave function. Who does the observer have to be? Does it have to be a physicist? Could it be me? Can it be my pet dog? Can it be a cockroach in the corner? I mean, what is the characteristic of the observer that makes that observer special?
Sorry, I should answer that.
philosophy. You don't want things to be respected.
Yeah. So your question was, what is it that makes the observer collapse away from
yeah.
But I would say that's a sort of God's eye point of view of the situation, but there is this wave function out there, independently of the observer, and therefore there's something to be collapsed in some sense. If you really take this radical point of view, I'm suggesting you don't have that. All you have is a collection of internal points of view. What I just said makes me nervous. So a physical theory is an attempt to correlate data. And the data is always collected in the kind of context I'm talking about. I mean, it could be a cockroach that is collecting the data, but nevertheless, it's always collected in that point of view. But I think what I'm suggesting is if you take it to its limit, at the rather radical point of view, I don't know if it's in that voice.
Perhaps if we have any cockroaches in the audience.
I was looking at you.
So nobody wants to go next. So I'll make that comment. There's.
I just wanted to find out if I'm reading you correctly. Is there a debate among physicists about whether Einstein's theory of general relativity breaks down at the quantum level? Am I reading you correctly on this, that is the debate? So such that with respect to the behavior of particles, that they may not conform to those principles?
Yes, so this has been a very serious issue for a long time, particularly since 1965, when John Bell produced a theorem saying that any, what's called hidden variables theory, the sort of theory I work on, for instance, where you have actual particle trajectories or could be other variables that determine the outcomes of experiments. He proved a general theorem showing that in any such theory, or let's say virtually any such theory, you had to have, at the fundamental level, you had to have instantaneous or faster-than-light effects, which we can't see directly, but at the underlying deeper level in this theory, they have to be there in order to explain certain correlations. And most physicists, the attitude of most physicists has been, well, relativity is fundamental. And in relativity, if you have things going faster than light, then with respect to a moving observer, they could go backwards in time and get all sorts of paradoxes. And so they concluded that, look, they can't be hidden variables. But it seems to me, and to some of physicists, not many, it seems to me a very illogical position to take. You have a theory of relativity which has been developed from experiments done at a certain level of physics, and it works at that level. And here we're debating the details or even the possible existence of a deeper level of physics that we all agree we haven't probed directly yet. So why should it be true that relativity, this theory developed at the level that we can observe directly, why does it have to be true at this deeper level? It might be true, it might not be true. Seems to be a very unscientific perspective to say that the theory that we have now developed at this level has to be true at the deeper level, and if you're going to propose a theory that contradicts that theory, then you must be wrong. It seems to me it's just not science. But it's certainly true that for most physicists, probably still today, this issue puts them against hidden variables, and also the sort of collapse theory that Wayne was talking about, but also difficulties in making that theory consistent with standard relativity.
Okay. We have a question over here first, and then a question over here.
So this is the question for Dr. Recently I took a course in quantum information, and they showed how classical world computers, when you basically throw away part of your system. And is that in line with the way you're talking about, we're immersed in this world, and the appearance of entropy only occurring once you sort of ignore, or trace it, once you ignore part of the system.
Okay, so I think that point of view has problems. It's an attempt to give what I would call a God's eye point of view, a description of the universe independently of ourselves, where you try to say that if you call a certain part of your system the environment and ignore it, then whilst it's mathematically true that the remaining part of the system might behave in a sort of apparently classical way, it's conceptually very difficult because you have to decide what the environment is and what's the system under consideration. So I think that approach has some problems associated with it.
Can I just add something to that? I mean, the sort of thing you're talking about, that is easiest to think about in sort of terms of your cat way. So suppose I treat everything quantum mechanically just as a wave function, I've got this very complicated superposition. Now it's not going to end with the cat. The cat's going to interact with stuff and what molecules will be bouncing off and stuff like that. And if I want to know, is this cat in the superposition or not, you know, has it collapsed one way or the other things, that is in principle an experimentally decidable question because you can take these two branches of the wave function and look for interference between them and define it and say, okay, I did have a quantum mechanical superposition. Now, if I just look at the cat and ignore the environment that it's interacted with, just looking at that cat, I won't be able to see that interference between those branches of wave functions. And the people that you were talking about then sort of, you know, wave their hands and try to fool themselves and say, well, that means that somehow the superposition has vanished because I can't. If I throw away part of the system, at the environment, I won't be able to observe the interference there at all. But I do think they're excluding themselves.
Okay, we have a question then to the front row.
Well, keeping with the spirit of a panel discussion that's lively with controversy, I'm gonna throw something in the mix here, so mix things up a little bit. I learned about quantum mechanics when I was in university, and every day when we started looking at experiments that were happening in the early 80s, we were amazed, because that was the time of Bell and some of the experiments that were being done. And what I came to understand later on was I could actually use these equations, and I did. I used these equations in some graduate work where I was actually modeling integrated circuit topologies and designing new types of transistors. So I saw it work firsthand. I mean, it actually works. I mean, I've never seen it fail. In not just things I worked on, but what I've seen around. So it's a very accurate description of reality, although we have no idea what's really going on. We have a model, we have equations, and we have procedures to predict things. And we use them every day, and yet we still really don't know. That's what we're arguing here today. Now, recently, a few years back, I read a book by Rick Deutsch. Again, to mix things up a little, but I noticed one thing was lacking today. We didn't discuss it. But in his book, Fabric of Reality, he puts out a very systematic explanation of something that's quite controversial. And I mean, when you read it, you know, when you hear about, you know, the many worlds theory, right, prediction of quantum mechanics, it's kind of wacky. But when you watch him develop quantum mechanics from first principles in this book and lead an expert, you know, it leads you to accept that the many worlds explanation actually does fit the experimental data, no matter how bizarre it appears. And I'd like to hear what your views are on that, because, you know, when I read it, I was pretty convinced. And it's very interesting. It also has some very interesting ways of explaining how the probabilities seem to make sense, too.
Okay, 1 minute for everyone else to probably see that anywhere else. Start with Anthony. Start with Anthony.
So, I think David Deutsch, first of all, is a very deep and knowledgeable thinker.
And I think that perhaps Wayne will comment on some people think there are some difficulties with that theory, technical difficulties with how you define probabilities and so on. Other people disagree. I'm not quite sure about that. But let's say if we forget for a moment the possibility that there are really difficulties with the theory, then, well, it could be true. It could be true. My view is that it is probably not true for the following reason. If you, and in fact Deutsch's presentation is a good example, if you read his description of the double slit experiment, where he is arguing for the existence of what he calls shadow photons, his argument, the gist of the argument, is basically this, that look, if this object here, you know, it was going to land at this point, but now it's landed at a different point, it must have been hit by something. It must have been hit by something. Basically, he's appealing to sort of common sense Newtonian ideas that if something is moved, it must have been affected by something close to it. And I think if you accept the idea that, well, maybe the world's not like that, maybe things can be affected by other things that are very far away, it doesn't have to be action by contact. In other words, giving up locality, giving up the idea that effects propagate at the speed of light, for example, then his arguments no longer hold. So it seems to me the many worlds theory, I'm just in one sentence, I would say, it's a sort of optical illusion, if you like, generated by thinking about the world in terms of classical Newtonian type ideas. That's my answer to your
question.
Okay. With this purposes, probably a lot of people are familiar with this, but closer on, the sort of view that we're talking about here is one that says the quantum mechanical wave function is everything there is, no extra hidden variables, and it involves according to the Schrodinger equation all the time. So at the end of the Schrodinger cat experiment, the cat's in a superposition of alive and dead state, I look at it, I join the superposition, and this is just the way it goes, and sort of picture, you know, these branches of the wave function all, you know, as if they're separate worlds. Why? So none of us mentioned that, and why not? Well, my main problem that has to do with both the first thing and the last thing he said. The first thing he said is, we've got all this wonderful evidence in favor of quantum mechanics, and that's why we're here talking about it. Now, a lot of the predictions of quantum mechanics are probabilistic. And the evidence for that is statistical, and so the evidence for quantum mechanics is evidence that the quantum mechanics is getting the probabilities right. It's not clear to me that Deutsch has succeeded in even making sense of probabilities in the many worlds interpretation. In fact, now this is something that some people disagree. I actually spent most of last weekend talking with some of the world's brightest young philosophers who were trying to defend the notion that, you know, on this kind of interpretation there is something that plays the role of probability. And the reason that's a crucial role is because if you can't get something that plays the role of probability such that you can say quantum mechanics is getting the probabilities right and all the statistical evidence is evidence to that effect, then we don't have good evidence that quantum mechanics is right and there's no reason for us to be sitting here talking about this theory. And this can go on and on, but I don't think that Deutsch or any of the people who've tried to improve on Deutsch's work have yet succeeded in making sense of probabilities on this view, because it is a deterministic theory. I know exactly what's going to happen when I do say Schrodinger cat experiment. It's not that the cat's going to be alive with this probability or dead with this probability. The wave function just splits with certainty into these two separate branches, and they're both there. So I'm not convinced that anyone has succeeded in making sense of probabilities in such a way that we get to say that all this statistical results counts as good evidence that one can't escape probabilities, right?
Yes, sir. Okay, so just to refer to what the Wayne was talking about, my response to the Medwell's interpretation used to be that there were serious technical problems that hadn't been addressed recently, people including Deutsch and also Simon's own
done a tremendous amount of technical work. And it might be that they have now sorted out the technical problems. In other words, it might be that the manual's interpretation is at least a coherent point of view, which is good. But the reason I don't subscribe to it is to do with this challenge I issued at the very end of my talk. In the Meyer-Wolf interpretation, as indeed in the pilot wave and collapse models, the basic equations of quantum theory are taken as they are given, and no attempt is actually made to derive them from some more fundamental ideas. And I think it's only by doing that kind of theoretical work that you can hope to get a real handle on why quantum theory is the way it is, and therefore how to interpret it. So that's the reason I think I don't subscribe to the Meyer-Wolf interpretation.
Before we move on, we have time for two more questions, but Anthony's chomping at the bit to reply to this. So very quickly, Anthony.
To reply to Lucien's challenge. So I think the situation at the moment is very similar to the situation we had in physics at the end of the 19th century, where people have developed the theory of thermodynamics, the science of heat and work, and things like the behavior of gases, how much if you compress a gas and then let it expand, how much work can you do with that, how much heat you have to put in, so on and so forth. All of that can be derived from two or three, if you like, very simple principles of conservation of energy and the principle that you can't convert heat into work at a single temperature, the second law of thermodynamics. Now, that doesn't change the factors that we know now, but beneath all this, gases are made of molecules, there are lots of complicated interactions going on. At that time, people were modeling this, what's called kinetic theory of gases, assuming that molecules like billiard balls are made of laws. And they were deriving the laws of thermodynamics from these deeper laws. So I think there's a moral there, that the fact that you can derive a theory, in this case thermodynamics, from simple principles, and just refer to macroscopic experiment in C and do, it doesn't mean that there isn't something deeper behind it. And the second moral is that if current science is, for example, at that time, all they could see were the macroscopic properties of gases, you couldn't, most many people believe that atoms didn't exist at all. To ask a physicist in 1890, you've got to give me the basic axioms for the behavior of atoms before I'll accept they exist, it seems to me that is just not realistic.
So you reject the challenge. Moving on to... we have time for two more questions. Preferably for people who haven't asked questions before, because these people have...
How does a quantum computer work?
How does a quantum computer work? That's perhaps we don't quite have time for that. A minute and a half left before we conclude.
The answer is it works very, very quickly.
Very, right, yes. According to Mike, it works very quickly. It's in development. So perhaps now